Questions? Questions?
I figured out the lab stuff. That exponential thing is tricky.
Okay. You're going to send me stuff anyway?
The chi-square was 1. So that made sense. But the unit, so the units, if it's b to any log or any exponential, it's unitless. Right? For me,
I think I mostly believe what you're saying. So if you have something like e to the b times x, then b times x has to be unitless. So b has to have the units of 1 over x. You mentioned log, but I don't think we have anything. I don't think there any of the functional forms have something like that in. But if there was something like that, it really should be b times x is unitless. I think that it's probably exactly 50-50.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I don't think you can guess.
Okay.
So we're talking about the lab practical. What lots of people are doing. So what I guarantee you is if you show up for the lab not having worked some of these example problems, you're screwed. I think so. So you absolutely want to work through some of these examples. And you don't have the answers, so the best bet is to email me your answers, and I will tell you what's right and wrong. Lots of people are doing that. Lots of people are doing half dozen. I don't have anyone who's done all of them yet, but people are doing large numbers of these and emailing me and maybe getting useful stuff back. One thing that might be useful is to know what we're going to be grading you on. And if you look at that same file at the very bottom, there's something that's called errorcodes11.pdf that shows you what we're looking for. So it's a list of things that we're going to take off 5 points per example. So if you miss the units on A, you're going to lose 5 points. If you miss the sig figs on A, you're going to lose 5 points, et cetera.
Let's say you have the right, sig figs and the right units, but you don't have the right answer. Do you still get points for your sig figs and units?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. And we won't take off things multiple times, so that if you messed up the sig figs 3 times, you'll only lose the 5 points once.
Are you bothered if we send you more than one?
No. People are sending me large numbers of them.
Okay.
More questions? So the web address that's in your lab manual shows where the practice ones are. Most of these things are not things that we've done in lab, functional forms that we've done in lab, so it's new and different. So the fact that you could do this in lab doesn't mean that you'll be able to do it on the lab practical unless you practice, I think.
I'm just curious, like, what's with all of a sudden?
Go ahead. So you're saying, why are we doing all of these funny functional forms now?
Yeah, like, it's not, I mean, if I just do something with dumb, it's not what the purpose of lab practical is.
Well, so, but what we're limited to what we can do in lab to pretty simple functional forms. Whereas, like the Arrhenius functional form, that's something that's on the list of things that you have to know for MCATs, right? So we want you to see the full range of possibilities. The general principles apply under all circumstances.
Does the lab practical count equal to many other labs?
Yes. Yep. So it's 100 points for a lab. So most of you have pretty good lab scores, so you don't want to spoil it by forgetting sig figs or something. And if you're set, it should be really fast, right? All you need to do is to enter the data, WAP it, do a simple calculation, write down a quick report form, do some
so
plots.
We only have one we have to do, though.
Correct.
You'll just pick one of those?
One or a similar sample, yes.
And all the samples are online on the class website?
There are 16 sample sets online. More questions? So, yep.
So when you're doing a spreadsheet and you want to, what's it called?
Self-document.
Self-document. You're not using X or Y for those, so can you just put it to the side of it then?
You pretty much have to put it to the side.
But you don't have to, like, I don't know, never mind. You just want the answer just, like, next to it, even though we're not using.
So let me give you an example. So in a typical problem, you will have found A and B, and then you'll have to make some sort of calculation. And you probably have A and B sitting in some cells in your spreadsheet. You don't have to do it that way, but that's probably how you're going to do it. And maybe the thing that you're going to calculate is A divided by B. And so, you know, you're just going to make that calculation in Excel, and then over here you're going to take out the equal sign, and it's going to have, you know, C1 divided by C2 or something is what you did. And then, of course, with the high-low method, you're going to have this as being A plus whatever the error is, and you might as well have the error over here. Right? Something like that to get the high value, and equivalent thing to get the low value. And you're going to take half the difference between these two. And all those things should be self-documented over there. More questions?
So there you're showing that you do A with A high divided by B and low B. It's not, it doesn't correspond, like you don't do high and high and then low and low.
That's correct, right? So it's not all plus signs. So how do you decide when they're plus or what's minus? So we're trying to get the combination that gives us a big number overall. And a small number in the numerator is what gives us a big number upstairs. You got to be a little bit careful with writing this sort of statement, though, because if B were negative, then to get a smaller value, I'd want to add it. So it's not like... Yeah, so you have to think for yourself, what's going to give me the highest and lowest possibility? Okay. And if you really want, you can try all possibilities and then pick out the highest of all of them and the lowest of all of them. That's fair game also. But usually with just a little bit of thought, and usually it just amounts to realizing that you want a small number in the denominator to make a big number overall. And often it doesn't even involve that, right? A lot of the calculations are just easier than that, dividing by 0.03 or something. More questions? So you should sign up, and if you're prepared, you'll be out of there in 15 minutes. Say again?
Homework questions.
So, 1 second before we talk about homework. So we were supposed to have a quiz today, but you all got the email that saying that we weren't going to have a quiz today. The quiz is postponed till Friday. It'll be on stuff that is what we're talking about today, simple harmonic motion sort of stuff, that sort of stuff. Any quiz type questions? Okay, homework type questions.
Okay, so for the third big problem, had like it gave you a wave,
a graph.
Yeah, a graph wave, like a sine wave graph. Mm-hmm. And it asked you to find
pretty much everything, like the maximum velocity, for example.
Yeah, I can't figure out how to get the material constant, like
the material constant
or whatever.
Oh, the spring constant.
Spring constant, I meant. Yeah.
We don't need the spring constant to answer any of those questions. So at least the version I'm looking at asks for the amplitude, and we can pick that off directly.
And what was the other one?
So the next one is period. We can pick those off, I think, pretty directly.
I don't know the next one.
The angular frequency, right? And that, if you know the period, you know the angular frequency. I guess it's not written up here, but omega is equal to 2 pi over t.
Omega is equal to 2 pi over t.
The period is 2 pi. No, the period is t.
Oh. So it's just pi over 2. In that case, say a period is 4 seconds.
Oh, yeah. Whatever t is, you plug it in. The maximum speed, hold off on that for a second. The maximum acceleration, hold off on that for a second. And the equation. Well, the equation is going to be a sine function. And the acceleration is always minus omega squared times x. So obviously, to get the biggest value of the acceleration, I want to use the biggest value of x. And same thing for the velocity. The biggest value of velocity is, I hope, obviously going to be a omega.
I just couldn't figure out how to get omega. So. Mm-hmm. Okay.
More questions?
Confused by the definition of t, I think.
Yeah, it's got the little things on it, right? Other questions? Okay, so the kind of point of these following sections of the book are there are lots of oscillations in nature, but most of them aren't springs and masses. And the idea is that in these more complicated systems where we have oscillations, you know, an insect wing that's oscillating, we can figure out the fundamental properties in analogy to this spring setup. So the plan is for these more general cases to take a look at the two equations that we have for simple harmonic motion. So one of them is that for a constant, we have the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. And these things are nicely related to each other. And the other equation we've got is F equals ma, so that the acceleration is minus k times x. So if we can make some other problem look like that, we can immediately write down what the period is for that more complicated motion, because that period is going to be given by that result. Right? The period is 2 pi over omega, and omega is the square root of k over m. Okay, so that's pretty abstract. How does this work for kind of real sort of situations? So let's think about the case of a pendulum. So a pendulum, of course, is moving on a circle. And it's not a spring and mass. So we can't kind of immediately figure out what the spring constant is, because it doesn't have a spring constant. But what we can do is work through the equations that we have for energy conservation. So we know that the kinetic energy of something that's rotating, has some angular speed omega, is 1/2 I omega squared, or maybe you used to know that. And that the gravitational potential energy is mgh, right? Where h is the height above some zero level. Might as well take the bottom to be height zero. And it's not looking particularly good. This equation doesn't look anything like that equation to me. So maybe we need to do some work. What's an equation for this height? Well, it's not, you can't really immediately write down what that height is. If you had been asked what this distance is, it would have been a lot easier, right? Because that's part of a triangle. And if the length of the pendulum is L and this angle is theta, then this distance here is L cosine theta. And of course, this is a circle. So this full distance is also L. So this height, it's just the full distance minus the other distance. So what we've got here is L times 1 minus cosine theta. And you remember that for a point particle, the moment of inertia is ml squared. So we could also have written down the energy is ml squared times omega squared plus mgl 1 minus cosine theta. Still doesn't look anything like that I can see. So the key step, and I'm sure this is something that you would never have guessed, is that, and those of you who have taken calculus might remember the Taylor series expansion. What is true is that 1 minus cosine theta is about equal to theta squared over 2. If you know that, then this thing starts to look a little bit more like now this starts to look a whole lot more like this, right? Theta is playing the role of x, and we have the angular speed that's playing the role of velocity. So in this analogy, it must be that this thing here is playing the role of mass, and this thing here is playing the role of spring constant. So it must be then that the period for this pendulum, 2 pi divided by what is playing the role of mass, namely ml squared, divided by what's playing the role of k, mgl.
This is kind of backing up, but where is the ml squared? How do we get what is the m in this case?
So m is the mass of this thing here. And I'm sure you've forgotten maybe that moments of inertia are the sums of the ml squareds.
Okay.
A different way of getting that same result would be to remember that the speed of something is the radius times omega. So if I plug that in here, I would have 1/2 the mass, and then the speed is the length of the thing times omega. So I get the same answer either way. Okay, so a lot of things cancel out here. One of those L's goes away, the mass goes away. And I claim that's the correct formula for the oscillation speed of a pendulum. It's not going to be perfectly accurate because this wasn't perfectly accurate, but it should be a good approximation to the speed of a pendulum. Now, if we deal with more complicated cases than balls on string, so if I hold this object up, it's not a ball on a string, but it does oscillate pretty much like a pendulum. So cases like this that are not balls on strings are called physical pendulums, and we can work the same problem pretty much the same way. So here I have this blob that is rotating about this point. You might remember that the important thing in this was the location of the center of mass. So let's say that the center of mass is some distance L from the pivot point. The gravitational potential energy is mg times the position of the center of mass. So this term is going to be exactly the same. The moment of inertia of that complicated object is not ml squared. But if it's a simple enough object, we could look up the moment of inertia in the tables. So generically then, we're going to have 1/2 I omega squared plus mgl 1 minus cosine theta, where this L is not the size of the object, it's the distance to the center of mass. Under these circumstances, I is playing the role of mass, and when we make the substitution that 1 minus cosine theta is about theta squared over 2. This thing is playing the role of the spring constant. And so we can immediately write down then that the period of a physical pendulum is 2 pi, the thing that's like mass, divided by the thing that's like k. Okay. So let's think about a rapid transit system. If we wanted a rapid transit system that was going to California, we'd obviously want to take the straight line route to California, which is west and a little bit down. Right, so if here's the Earth, here we are, here's California. The railroad track should run straight. And since this is a nice physics class, let's make them frictionless railroad tracks. So the train starts here and it's going to slide down the tracks. And energy conservation says it's going to go to the other side. We just get off the train in California. We don't have to put any coal in the train, right? Because everything's nice and frictionless. It's downhill all the way except the uphill part. So how long does it take to do that? How long is the trip to California? Well, we know if, and let's go make this a little bit further than California. Let's go to Japan. Just so I have a bigger piece to draw on. So here's my train, of course. It's going to be attracted to the center of the Earth. And we don't care about the vertical, the normal component of the force, we only care about the horizontal component of the force. That's the thing that's going to accelerate it. So what is this force? What is the force if we dig a tunnel inside the Earth? And I don't know if you remember this story. There are people who actually at least pretend to believe this. I don't know if they really do. There are people who believe that the Earth is a shell and we're living on the inside of this shell. I told you it's crazy. I'm not sure I believe that they actually believe it, but there are people who have presented this as a possibility. So the idea is that, of course, we've got this rock here, so the gravitational attraction of this rock is going to be pulling us that away. So we're walking around on the inside of this sphere. How this works if you go to the moon is less than perfectly clear, but people don't have to be. I mean, people look at horoscopes too, right? So.
What? How does that
make any sense?
Because under that ridiculous of a model, wouldn't you just fall down when you went to the top?
Say again?
Under that ridiculous of a model, wouldn't you just fall down when you went to the top?
Why would you go to the center?
No, to the top.
But there's no top, right? This is the Earth floating in space.
There is no top. So gravity still works, it just works backwards?
No, it doesn't work backwards. Gravity attracts mass to mass, right? So here you have this mass. Maybe there's a mile of mass under you.
Oh, okay.
And that's what's holding you in place.
Oh, that's still really
stupid. Yeah, don't deny that. So what is the force on this guy, given that he's being attracted that way? Because there is some of this mass up here that, of course, is going to be pulling them that way. How does that all work out? And we actually talked about this. The answer is there is no force. You could float around on the inside of this Earth.
What? Why are we using this model?
Well, so it just turns out that things cancel out, that sure, this mass is going to pull you this way. There's more mass here that's pulling you this way, but it's further away. It turns out that they exactly cancel. So that if you were inside a shell, a spherical shell, there'd be no force on you.
We should bring this idea to NASA and have them restart up with this idea.
Well, it's kind of like going to China, right? We could go, instead of going west to go east, we could go up to go east.
Oh. So we need to make a new Earth.
No, this is the way the Earth is. To properly thinking people.
Wouldn't you be able to look up and see China, though?
It's pretty far away. It's 6,000 miles away.
So the stars are actually lights.
I don't think so. I think the stars are someplace out here too, but I've never really figured it out. I mean, there are people who believe in the flat Earth, so this is not much weirder than that. Okay, so the question was why are we talking about this? So if we want to figure out the force on this train, the important consequence is that we need to add up the effect of all of the mass, but all of the mass outside makes no net force. So we can effectively ignore all of this mass because it's not going to make a net force. So the only force that's going to be pulling this train along is the force due to the mass that's inside that area.
So the closer you get to the center of the Earth, the less gravity.
Yeah, that itself is pretty obvious, right? Because literally at the center of the Earth, which way would you be pulled? So the forces exactly all cancel there. If you're, 3 miles from the center of the Earth, which incidentally is, 3 miles, it's back being solid, but there's liquid in between. So there would be some small force that would be still pulling you towards the center. And that force would be just dependent upon the mass that's interior to your current location.
So in the matrix, everyone in Zion should be floating around.
Yes. They're not way inside the Earth, are they?
They're in the core of the Earth.
I never was cognizant of that. If I was, I would like that movie a lot less. Core of the Earth is not a good place to be. Certainly the human batteries were a really stupid idea for that movie.
We may regenerate so much heat.
Anyways, back to the
core. No, we're not going to talk about how it works because it doesn't.
Okay, that's the answer I want.
Okay, so let's figure out what the force is of this guy. So what we need to do is we need to calculate all of the mass that's interior, and then we can use Newton's formula, right? Newton says that the force of gravity is the mass divided by the distance squared. So how much mass is interior? Well, we can figure out that from the density of the Earth, right? We need the density times the volume of the sphere that's interior to where that train is. Okay, so this is the mass of the train. This is the mass that's interior to the train. R is the current distance from the train to the center of the Earth. And G is Newton's gravitational constant. Okay, so let's bring back the picture. Here's the train. Here's the center of the Earth. Here's this force that we're talking about that's pulling it towards the center of the Earth. And of course, we only care about this component that is pushing you along the tracks. Well, what's that component? Well, we can make a nice little triangle here. So let's call the distance from the midpoint of the tunnel x, and the distance to the from the current location to the center of the Earth is what we called r. And what we want is, we've got this force here. We need this force that's pulling us along, and we can use that from the sine of this angle. So this force is this force times the sine of theta. Let me write it over here because I need a little bit more room. And the sine of theta is x over r. And that force we said was g, the mass interior, which was the density times 4/3 pi r cubed divided by r squared. And notice all of the r's actually disappear. We got 3 upstairs, we got 3 downstairs. So the force that's pushing us along the tracks is g rho 4/3 pi times x. And technically speaking, there should be a minus sign here, right? Because if x is positive, the force is in the opposite direction.
How did the x over r get over to the other side?
It didn't get to the other side, right? All I did is substitute in that sine of theta is x over r.
Okay. Oh, and then you're saying on equal side, the equal side. How did it get over? over so you can cancel them out.
So this was the force, right?
Yep.
And this is sine of theta. And this is the force that's pushing the train along.
Okay. That's the density sine, right?
Yes, that's the density sine. No pressures, I think, today. This is a little bit obscure.
So why is the g negative?
That's just a matter of direction. If we have a positive displacement, the force is pushing us towards the center, right? So it's just like a spring, and that's the main point. The bigger you go this way, the bigger the force is that's pulling you that way. So I hope you see how this is going to work out. We can set F equal to the mass times the acceleration of the train. And we look at our equations. And we can see what's playing the role of K and what's playing the role of M. And it must be that the period of this motion is 2 pi, the square root of the mass of the train, I dropped this M. So that should have been there. Divided by this K. And it's kind of no surprise, right? Usually the mass of the object under the force of gravity is going to cancel out.
Okay, so there's an M, like not an M, that's added to all the equations now, right?
Right, so this is the mass of the train.
Okay.
And this was the mass of the Earth, basically.
Okay.
We're good? So there... several kind of, so first of all, what is this number? So, I don't know, the density of the Earth is kind of hard to look up, but the mass and the radius of the Earth is pretty easy to look up. So the density of the Earth is, of course, the mass of the Earth divided by 4/3 pi times the radius of the Earth cubed. And if we plug that in here, we've got the period is 2 pi square root of 1 over capital G, and now we've got M divided by 4/3 pi R cubed times 4/3 pi. It's going to simplify quite nicely with those 4/3 pi's canceling out. So we're going to get 2 pi square root of R cubed divided by G times the mass of the Earth. Okay, so if I plug those numbers in, and they're pretty easy to find at this point, what I get when I convert to minutes is 84 minutes. And that's the period, right? That's how long it takes it to go round trip. So 42 minutes to get to California. So one of the very surprising features of this is it doesn't matter whether this is California or Perth or Las Vegas or London, it's all the same time. So you want to go to St. Ben's, all you have to do is take the straight approach, and 42 minutes, about the same as waiting for a bus in the bus time, you could slide to St. Ben's along the straight line path. Okay?
So that's just you basically being on a pendulum from your position on the Earth to another position on the opposite.
Well, it's not a pendulum, I would say, because it's straight.
Right? Well, yeah, but like gravity acts as like...
Yeah. Yep, it is like a spring. It works exactly like a spring. Oh. Right? So if you go to this location, you could just sit here and oscillate back and forth if you didn't want to go to California or Minnesota. It also take 42 minutes to go from one side to the other, right?
Why does it just need to get frictionless stress?
Well, because our answer didn't depend on anything. Our answer doesn't have a distance 2 in it. It's surprising.
Why?
I mean, there's the answer. It didn't depend on where California was at all. This was the answer for all paths.
If we're going through the middle of the Earth?
Yeah, so we could go to Australia straight through the middle of the Earth. It's a little bit liquidy down there, but theoretically you could go straight through. Take 42 minutes to go to Australia. So what we're doing is we're making an analogy. So we have for the spring, we have that. And for us, we had MA is minus G 4/3 pi rho X. Is that what we had? M. And then we can make an identification that this thing is just like K. And the mass is just like the mass. So it's not a matter of using that equation, it's a matter of making an analogy to that equation and knowing that that equation has already been solved. We know that that equation produces simple harmonic oscillation with a frequency, angular frequency, that is square root of k over m. So once we've done it for springs, it should be true for anything else that is analogous. All we have to do is figure out what the equivalent k is and the equivalent mass is.
Is k usually negative?
K is usually positive. K has to be positive. Well, almost always positive. There's that minus sign in front of it. And the minus sign in front of it is just saying that the force is in the opposite direction of the displacement, right? When I pull this thing down, the spring is pulling it up. That's all the minus sign means. Okay. So that was problem 73, except they were going straight. I don't really like to go straight because it gets liquidy down there. But certainly going to California, I can't really say there's no problem, but there are fewer problems. Okay, so let's take a look at 72. So again, the plan for these problems is to analyze what's going on and find an analogy to one of these two equations. Pick out the equivalent value of K and M, and then we can figure out automatically what the period is, because it has to be the analogous quantity. So what we have for 72 is we have rubber bands that have some tension in them, and we're going to displace this thing that's at the midpoint up, and of course it's going to jiggle up and down. It's not a spring, but the claim is that we can calculate what the frequency is going to be by using this analogous process, and that's going to be the answer. So let's see. So the setup is we've got this rubber band, we've got this object in the middle. We're calling this some distance L. We displace this thing up some distance Y. What is the force that's going to push it back? Well, the force that's pushing it back are those two forces at those angles. So these tensions are at some tension that they're calling F. And of course, there's a horizontal component. Those are going to cancel. But the vertical components are going to add. The force is going to be in the opposite direction of the displacement, so there's going to be kind of a minus sign in it. And with luck, there'll be something like a K factor. So obviously what we need is this angle theta. So one of these forces is going to be, boy, that looks kind of funny. Let me call it F sub Y. One of these forces is going to be F times the sine of theta. And the sine of theta is the hypotenuse over the opposite side. So that's y divided by the square root of y squared plus l squared. And of course, for the whole force, we've got two of these things. And we know that F equals oops, and I should have a minus sign here too, right? Because the force is in the opposite direction of y. And we know that the force is equal to the mass times the acceleration. So, I don't know, it doesn't look exactly like this. And it's not exactly like this, right? But if you think about it, if this L is something like a meter, and we displace this thing like a centimeter, this hypotenuse is going to be pretty much the same as L. So we can approximate for small values of y the hypotenuse as an edge. In which case, what we've got then is 2fy divided by L is equal to the mass times the acceleration. Now this looks a whole lot like this equation, right? We've got a mass, and this thing here is apparently the equivalent value of k. So it must be that the up and down motion has a period that is 2 pi, the equivalent mass, which is just m, divided by the equivalent k, which is 2f divided by l. Oh, so actually they're asking for omega. So omega is the square root of k over m, and k is 2f over l, and we're supposed to divide by mass. So it's exactly what's up there.
Why do you have a square root on the bottom of that equation?
Because the sine of an angle is the opposite over the hypotenuse. So here's the opposite, there's the hypotenuse.
Oh, you did like type A.
Mm-hmm. So the hypotenuse is given to us by Pythagorean theorem.
Okay, so then what is the reason why that doesn't look like the negative kx part? Is that because y is also on the bottom?
Yeah, yep.
Okay, so how come we can assume that y in that case may be very small, but then we can't assume that the y on top would be like zero as well?
So when this thing's oscillating, y is going to be a variable, right? So it's not like y has a particular value. But the range of possibility for y, if it's going to be a simple harmonic oscillator, has to be small.
Okay. But we don't do anything with the y on top in that case to get it. Because in order to get it from there to the other one, the simplified one, we just assume that y in that case is a small number.
Yeah. So I think your question is, okay, why is small? Why is this thing, why am I holding on to this one and not holding on to that one?
Yeah.
And for small values of a quantity, y squared is smaller than y.
Okay.
Right? So if you think about y being a tenth, then y squared is going to be a hundredth.
Right. Okay.
So so that's why this term didn't contribute as much. That x is what?
Y.
Yes, yep, that's the analogy we're making.
Okay.
And of course here, literally what's oscillating is y, but
right.
When we had the horizontal one, it was oscillating an x. What we call the oscillating variable doesn't matter.
Okay.
Okay, so the plan is kind of one step further than we usually are. We have these equations, which are true for a simple harmonic oscillator. We're gonna take a different physical situation and try and make it look like one of these things. And then we can just read off what the corresponding period of oscillation is.
How did you cancel off one of the L's at the bottom? Because it was like L squared
first. Well, so if y is negligible, then the square root of L squared is L.
Oh.
How is
y negligible?
Because we're thinking about it being small. So it would not be true if y were as big as L. So I'm thinking that y is a tenth or a hundredth of L.
And how do we know, like, when it's negligible or not?
Well, so I think, does this thing say that it's small? Yep, it says that it's by a small distance y.
Like, I guess if I were to, like, look at that, I would, if I knew that Y was, like, now knowing that Y is X in this case, like what we want to get it to, then I would know that Y on the bottom has to be close to Z. You know, we'd have to cancel that out. So is that kind of like the approach?
Yeah, so kind of the starting point, and maybe I didn't thinking about pointing this out. If this thing is oscillating up and down, then Y has to be the thing that's like X.
Okay.
And as I say, the simplification of the denominator, it's only the case if Y is small. If we take these rubber bands and we stretch them, you know, two times what L is, this formula is not true. The same thing is true of the pendulum. If I use very big swings on the pendulum, it's not going to be given by that equation. Turns out that the swings have to be more than about 30 degrees before you get even a 1% variation. So it takes pretty big swings for a pendulum to deviate, but it does. The famous dead physicist Galileo claimed that what I just said was false, but he was wrong. I've got one up on Galileo. It's incidentally hard to figure out how Galileo got it wrong. I guess that's another story. No, we don't have time. Okay. So these are kind of tricky problems, I agree, where we're making these analogies, and it's not the sort of problem where you can see linearly where you're going to end up from where you're starting from. So I just tell you that I recognize that that's the case. So let's look at easy problems. So 32 is a basic plug and chug sort of problem. What we're told is that the period of a pendulum is 15.5 seconds, and therefore calculate how long the pendulum is. Okay, and I'm sure the equation is erased, but what we had was the period of the pendulum was 2 pi square root of L over G. So we're told that T is 15.5 seconds. We know that G is 9.8. And we're supposed to calculate L. So L is under a radical, so we're going to have to square to get rid of it. So we're going to have T squared is equal to 2 pi squared L over G. And then one more step. If we bring the G up and the 2 pi down, we've got that L is T squared times G divided by 2 pi squared. So again, T is going to be 15.5, G is going to be 9.8, and if we plug and chug, so I got the 15 squared, I want to multiply that by 9.8, and then I got the 2 and the pi, and then I want to square that and divide that, and I get 59.6. So what do you mean a constant?
Like, is that always the case?
Like, so this is always the case for your standard pendulum. So remember that the physical pendulum, where we had, you know, like that thing that was oscillating, there we had to use the moment of inertia.
Okay.
So for any ball on a string sort of situation, that's true. Okay, so then they take it to the moon. What's going to be the period? So the period is 2 pi. We know now that L is 59.6, and they tell us that G on the moon is 1.67. So it's a straightforward plug and chug. And I get 37.5 seconds. Gravitational force is smaller, so all of the motions are slower. Okay, So here's more of a standard question, the sort of question that you had for your existing homework. What we have is this little toy. When we push the spring down, when we compress it by 2 centimeters and release it, it's going to fly up 60 centimeters. And they ask us, what's the spring constant of the spring that's doing the work? So this is a conservation of energy problem. Kind of the only thing that's new is, in addition to spring potential energy, we've got gravitational potential energy. And the gravitational potential energy is mgh. And kind of the first thing you need to ask yourself is, where am I going to take h equals 0? And the logical point to take it, I think, is where it started from, right? So here's the ground. Here's this highly compressed spring. Let's take that to be h equals 0. We're going to release this thing that's going to fly up, and it's going to end up at a height of 0.6 meters. So the initial energy, there, it's not moving, so there's no kinetic energy. It's at height equals 0, so there's no gravitational potential energy. But the spring has been cocked, right? It does have spring potential energy. And the amount of compression of the spring is 2 centimeters, 0.02 meters. At the top of the flight, it was going up and it's about to go down, so currently its velocity is 0. So there's no kinetic energy. There's lots of gravitational potential energy, but the spring is sitting here uncompressed, so there's no spring potential energy. And conservation of energy tells us that the energy at the start has to equal the energy at the end. We know the mass, it's 0.1. We know g, 9.8. The height is 0.6. The only thing we don't know in this equation is k, which is exactly what they asked us to calculate. Okay, so we've got mgh is 1/2 kx squared. So we've got k is equal to 2mgh divided by x squared. So we've got 2 times 0.1 times 9.8 times 0.6 meters. Boy. All divided by 0.02 squared. Okay, so 2.1 times it, 9.8 times that, 0.6 times that, 0.02 squared and divide, and I get 2,940. I haven't talked about units for a while, so maybe this is as good a time as any to talk about units. So we've got an mg there, so that's going to give us newtons times meters divided by meters squared. And so we're going to get newtons per meter, which is exactly what the normal units of spring constant are. Okay, yep.
The only reason I thought of this is because I accidentally made it. What does it mean when you have like an equal sign that has three lines in it?
So that's a definition. So for we had the definition of viscosity as a, it was pretty complicated, right? The force, the velocity difference divided by an area. That was really a definition of viscosity.
Okay.
So I guess one example is kinetic energy is defined to be 1/2 mv squared. But it's kind of a particularly important equal sign.
Like, does that mean it's always true?
Yes, it's always true. It's but true by definition. Okay, so here we combine springs and conservation of energy. What else did we do on the old exams? Well, conservation of momentum. So let's combine springs with conservation of momentum. It's fun, yeah. What could be better to do it? 15 minutes less that left the, with class. Okay, so what we're going to have here, we've got a 5-gram bullet moving at 400 meters a second. It's going to go right through this block of wood, and it's going to exit, and in the end we're supposed to figure out what its exit speed is. Meanwhile, because of this collision, this block has picked up some velocity. It's going to compress this spring to some maximum amount. So using all of that information, we're supposed to figure out what the exit speed is of the bullet. Okay, so collision, bullet, and block, you should be thinking conservation of momentum. And momentum is mass times velocity. So what we've got then is, I'll let lowercase m be the bullet, and capital M, if you can tell the difference, be the block. So initially, the bullet has some momentum, and they tell us that the mass is 0.05 kilograms and the velocity is 400 meters a second. In the final state, the block is moving at some velocity. We do know the mass of the block is 1 kilogram, but we sure don't know what the final velocity of the block is, 1 second. And the bullet is going to exit with some final velocity. Yes?
That's 0.005, right?
Yes. Okay. And the mass of the bullet is 5 grams. Well, that's true, but it's one equation and there are two things in it that we don't know. So it's not looking super good.
Why wasn't there kinetic energy at the beginning?
Say again?
Why wasn't there kinetic energy initially?
So I haven't used the word kinetic energy. I used the word momentum.
Oh, originally one moving in. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're talking about momentum conservation. No, I'm not going to use any lowercase p's in this problem. Everything's going to be m times v, which is a lowercase p, but I won't draw it. Okay, so how can we figure out what the mass of the block was post-collision? Well, it's the kinetic energy of the block post-collision that's going to be converted into potential energy when it compresses the spring. So we have conservation of energy, where we have this block that's moving at this velocity is being converted into a compressed spring. So in this situation, we have lots of kinetic energy, but the spring is currently uncompressed. In the final situation, we have a maximum compression, which means that the velocity is zero, but we've got some spring potential energy. Conservation of energy tells us that this is that, right? The initial energy has to equal the final energy. So we can calculate the final velocity of the block because 1/2 mvb squared has to be 1/2 kx squared. And they told us that the block compressed by 5 centimeters. And they told us the spring constant is 900. And we already know that the block weighs 1 kilogram. So we know everything in that equation except VB. So the 2's go away. And the velocity is going to be the square root of kx squared divided by m. So that's 900 times 0.05. It's 5 centimeters, right? Yes, 5 centimeters. And the mass of the block is 1. So that final velocity of the block, we got 900, we got 0.05 squared times, and then square root. And I get, boy, nice even number, 1.5 meters per second. It's not looking good, right? We only have one unknown in one equation. So 400 times 0.005 That's 2. So I have 2 is equal to 1.5 plus MVF. So I have 0.5, subtracting those two, is MVF. So the final velocity is going to be the 0.5 units of momentum divided by the 0.005, the 5 grams of mass. And I can do that in my head. That's 100 meters a second. Okay, so the bullet came in at 400 meters a second. It knocked the block, moving it to 1.5 meters a second. It went right through the block, exiting at 100 meters a second. Okay, questions? Well, we've gone through all of the usual problems, so let's do a homework problem. Yeah, so the last homework problem has to be the hardest homework problem, is 70. So 70 is pretty similar to what we've been doing. So here we have a gun, a pellet gun, with a highly compressed spring and a bullet. And what we're going to do is we're going to release the spring, so the bullet is going to be exiting at some high speed. Sounds like conservation of energy. And the gun is aimed horizontally. This is the kind of old part of the question. We're supposed to figure out where the bullet hits the ground. Well, I hope this part is pretty clear, right? That's conservation of energy. We can get to that in a second. I bet it's the old part that's going to give you problems. And the old part is the old kill the dinosaur problem, right? It's one that you've done before. If you shoot horizontally from some height h, where's the bullet going to hit the ground? Given that we know the exit velocity. Well, you might look back on your old cheat sheets and you will find these useful and constant equations, right? Delta x is equal to v sub o t plus 1/2 a t squared. V is equal to v sub o plus a t. V squared is equal to V naught squared plus 2a delta x. And V plus V naught over 2 is delta x over t. I imagine you didn't remember those, but at least you remember that you used to know those equations. And the other important fact to remember is that what goes on vertically is totally distinct from what's going on horizontally. So I can figure out when this bullet hits the ground by just thinking about a falling bullet as opposed to the more complicated two-dimensional problem. So if I'm going to concern myself with a falling bullet, I mean, traditionally we use this upward vertical direction for y, but that's going to lead to lots of kind of funny minus signs. It'll be easier if we take the y direction going down, and that's actually what we did in the dinosaur problem. Because then the acceleration of gravity is in the same direction, and when it hits the ground, it's at a positive value of y. There are not all these minus signs going around. So if we do that and transcribe the x's to y, so we have delta y, there's, in my falling chalk problem, there's no initial y velocity. I didn't throw it down. I threw it sideways, but sideways is totally separate from down. So there's no term like that. And we've said that the acceleration is the acceleration of gravity. And we're asking, when is delta y equal to the height of the gun? And it's a plug and chug, right? So the time is equal to 2 times h divided by g square rooted. Well, they didn't ask us for the time it hit the ground. They said, where is it going to hit the ground? For the horizontal motion, there's no acceleration. So the change in x is just the velocity in the x direction, which is constant, times time. And we're interested in the particular time when it's hitting the ground. So we've got that as our basic equation. So we'd be all set if we had the muzzle velocity. We don't have that yet, but it's not going to be that tricky. So the initial energy is no kinetic energy. Nothing's moving at the start. We have a compressed spring, which has lots of stored energy in it. How much energy does it have? Well, they've told us that the spring constant is, and this is funny, 9.8, right? So it's not 9.8 meters a second. I don't know why they chose that confusing number. The spring constant is 9.8 newtons per meter. And the spring has been compressed by 20 centimeters. Okay, so that's the initial energy. In the final state, the thing is moving, but the spring is uncompressed. Conservation of energy guarantees us that the initial energy is the final energy. So the muzzle velocity of the bullet came from the potential energy of the spring. 100% of the potential energy of the spring was converted into kinetic energy of the bullet. So the twos go away. And we've got that the initial velocity is the square root of kx squared over m. And this bullet weighs 1 gram. And we've said that k is this funny value of 9.8 and x is 0.2. Okay, so we got 9.8, 0.2 that we're supposed to square. And we're supposed to divide everything by 0.001. And I get pretty much 2 meters a second, 1.98 meters per second. So then we can plug and chug that into this range equation. The gun was held, I think, 1 meter above the ground. Yep, 1 meter above the ground. This is a 9.8 meters a second. So I've got 2 divided by 9.8. Take the square root of that and multiply it by our previous result. And I get 8.9 meters. I probably should have done an odd problem, so I could be embarrassed if I did it wrong. I think that there is nothing new about this. Okay. We did energy conservation problems just like this, and this is the dinosaur kill problem. Why springs are coming after steam engines, I don't know. Doesn't seem like the right place.
Is that a bullet being launched to the spring? How is a spring even part of this?
So it's a spring-loaded gun.
Oh.
So it's the spring that's accelerating the bullet. Well, this is for your nephew, not.
But what if our nephew has a pneumatic gun?
So we could work that with ideal gas if you want. I think we did a problem like that, didn't we?
We can calculate our magnitude.